Blog Talk Radio.
I got a letter from the government the other day. I opened and read it and burned that. Man, the way that I live, no concern that. Man, we gon' have to settle this another way. A letter from the government the other day. I opened and read it and burned that. Man, the way that I live, no concern that. Man, we gon' have to settle this another way.
Movement, music, move into it. Put a fist up, prove it to us. This is much more than music to us. This is beauty and strength. And if you know about the music, then you know about life. This movement, music, move into it. Put a fist up, prove it to us. This is much more than music to us. This is beauty and strength. And if you know about the music, then you know about life.
Word.
Any kind of activity that takes place on the floor of the Congress or the Senate, that's the government. Any kind of dilly-dallying, that's the government. Any kind of pussy-footing, that's the government. Any kind of act that's designed to delay, or deprive you and me right now of getting full rights, that's the government that's responsible. And any time you find the government involved in a conspiracy,
I can never go back. Life without parole, upstate, shackled and trapped. Living in the hole, looking at the world through a crack. Fuck that, I'd rather shoot it out and get clapped. I've gone too far, there ain't no coming back for me. Auschwitz gas chamber full of Zyklon B. Just like the Spanish exterminating Tainos, raping the black and Indian women, creating Latinos. Motherfucker, made me out of self-righteous hatred. And now you got yourself a virus, stuck in the matrix. A suicide bomber, strapped and ready to blow. Lethal injection, strapped down, ready to go. Don't you understand, they'll never let me live out in peace. Concrete jungle, guerrilla war out in the streets. Nat Turner with the sickle, pitchfork and machete. The end of the world, motherfucker, are you not ready?
DJ Tony Drake.
This is DJ Tony Drake, a.k.a. Mr. Top Self himself. And right now, you're in tune to Your World News, where journalism and activism are not mutually exclusive. Here on yourworldnews.org.
You can't tell me life was meant to be like this. A black man in a world dominated by whiteness ever since the Declaration of Independence. We've been easily brainwashed by just one sentence. It goes, all men are created equal. That's why corrupt governments kill innocent people. With chemical warfare, they created crack and AIDS. Got the public thinking these were things that black folks made. And every time there's violence shown in the media, usually it's a black thing. So where are they leading you? To a world full of ignorance, hatred and prejudice. TV and the news for years, they're prejudiced. Foolish notion that blacks are all criminals, violent lowlifes, and then even animals. I'm telling the truth, so some suckers are fearing me, but I must do my part to combat the conspiracy.
Welcome to another edition of Your World News. I'm your host, your faithful host, Solomon, and we got a great show for you. I'm not going to keep saying we got another great show for you, but we got a great show for you, period. We have one of my comrades coming on this program at about half past, or I shouldn't say half past anything. We're starting half past the hour, but in about another 27 minutes, we're going to be joined by Mr. Obiek Buna, who, as you all know, is the correspondent, the U.S. correspondent to the Zimbabwe Herald, which is Zimbabwe's national newspaper. And we'll also be joined by Brother Mr. Biku Dada, who is the son of the revolutionary activist, Pan-African, you know, Mukasa Dada. So they'll be joining us this evening for this show, and I guess maybe wherever you listen to, if you're listening to the archive, it may be this morning, wherever you are, but right now as we presently record this program. It is 6:30 or 6:35 right now, August 22nd, 2000, or is it August? Yeah, I believe it is August 22nd, August 22nd, 2011. And without further ado, I want to bring on Andreas Murillo, who is your other faithful co-host. And as you know, she was on assignment last week. She wasn't with us, so it's nice to have Andrea back in the driving seat, you know, with us as we continue to drive this program straight into the consciousness of as many listeners as we possibly can to build this this movement for freedom, liberation, and fight against all kinds of social injustices, including white supremacy, institutional racism, imperialism, neocolonization, and so much. I mean, there's so much to be discussed as we even look at, you know, the chairs coming from so many obsequious Americans chairing for, you know, the downfall of Libya, you know, not even considering the fact that the nation of Libya has been bombed into oblivion by the U.S. and its NATO, NATO allies, and this rebel force that has been promoted as this force of good, despite the fact that this rebel force in Libya is responsible for specifically targeting masses of black Africans in Libya, and because they were sympathizers for Gaddafi, targeting them, you know, some that even were that had no relationship, you know, to either side, but were simply in Libya working, and were targeted by the rebels, many strung up and lynched, you know, as if this was the 1700s in Mississippi, lynched, burned, hatcheted, you know, murdered, and no discussion of this in the mainstream media whatsoever. So we got a lot of stuff to talk about, and we certainly will. So I'm going to welcome on the program right now Ms. Andrea Zamudio, and I want, Andrea, you to tell us right now, not in a short take, but give us a deep, not, you know, you were off last week, so I don't want to hear the short one or two sentence response, but I want to know what is on your mind as we move forward with this show and as we embark upon this week right here. This what's on your mind?
It's good to be with you again, Solomon. I was driving home today listening to NPR, who also has a very one-sided perspective on the issue in Libya. And, you know, it was interesting to hear the host talking about, he's speaking this to, I believe, a professor, saying something about if the U.S. would have been more involved in terms of supplying more Tomahawks and just more weapons to the rebels, and wouldn't have fallen back, supposedly, like they did, and allowing NATO to take control. This would have been over a long time ago, because they would have been able to bomb Libya more, and so Gaddafi would have been out of power quicker. And this would have saved more lives, apparently. And so
right.
I just don't even know how someone can make a statement like that, and then even worse, people can hear something like that and not, like, not be like, what? Like, what did that person just say? Like, really think about, oh, so, like, if we would have bombed this country more, then we would have saved them, and it would have been a better humanitarian mission. I mean, that doesn't make any type of sense to me. And then he said something interesting. I can't recall this man's name, but he said that one of the people who was involved in creating this supposed humanitarian intervention in Libya was a military architect for the invasion in Afghanistan. And so I think that says a lot, because clearly they had no, and he even said this, you know, the U.S. had no intention of, or they had the intention of getting Gaddafi out from the beginning. Even though that's not what they said, but, and now that's clear, but that wasn't, you know, that's not what they were saying in the beginning, because they wanted people to think that this was just supposedly to, you know, to save the civilians. But I don't know. I mean, I'm just thinking a lot about this. I know that off air we were discussing how even the representation in Democracy Now!, which is one of the bigger, you know, independent news outlets in the U.S., has taken a very one-sided stance on Libya, and it's just disturbing. You know, I mean, it's, I know that it's, like, been kind of a issue of contention in the left, but I think that I would expect from independent news to at least, if, you know, if they're not in agreement or whatever, they would have representatives from both sides, as I've seen Democracy Now! Do before on other issues. You know, they have someone on the show that they don't necessarily agree with, or maybe you think that from their perspective they don't agree with, but they have them on the show nonetheless to allow, you know, to have a platform that has multiple perspectives on an issue. And they're not doing that with Libya, and we've already discussed about how it hasn't been done with Al Jazeera, and there's a reason with Al Jazeera, but...
But I mean, here's the thing, and that's why Democracy Now! Has to be scrutinized, you know, just as hard as these other ones. I mean, I even throw out all the other stuff in the past, because, I mean, one thing that you know, black folks in the left have always scrutinized, you know, Democracy Now! Is that they have a very, you know, they've had black guests on before, but in comparison to their white guests from the left, I mean, they rarely have black, you know, guests on their program that are from the far left, folks who have full of perspectives, full of knowledge, full of information. It should be very, very curious to anybody that knows what's going on in terms of, you know, looking at, you know, the role Cynthia McKinney has been playing with Libya, the fact that she actually went over there, risked her life, and went over there with a delegation of folks like Dr. Randy Short, Wayne Madsen, you know, and others, went over there, not once but twice, risked her life, and just interesting, and it's no secret. I mean, Cynthia McKinney has been on a tour, you know, with folks like Akbar Muhammad and other folks, you know, traveling throughout the country, giving talks about their fact-finding mission and what they saw on the ground. And Andrea, I mean, it should be very curious. Why the hell hasn't Cynthia McKinney been on the show? Because I could be wrong, but I'm almost certain that if she was invited, she would have come on the show. So I'm almost certain, and I can't, you know, say with all, you know, certainty that she has been, that she has or hasn't been on the show. But being somebody who has who has spoken to Cynthia McKinney before, who has exchanged, you know, correspondence with her and seen her work, and to see the fact that she understands the importance to get this information out there and has, you know, availed herself to do these tours and to be on, you know, many radio shows, such as she's been on programs on WPFW discussing this issue, as well as other radio stations, you know, throughout the country, independent radio stations. That I'm certain the reason why she hasn't been on Democracy Now! Is because she hasn't been invited, you know, and so that it's like, that's crazy, you know what I'm saying? That's a former Democratic congresswoman, you know, former presidential candidate for the Green Party, and has been one of those beacons of justice, truth, and justice, and liberation, the globe over. You know, with her work and her travels and her, you know, her reputation. And it's just interesting that, you know, she hasn't been invited on the show. I mean, she just hasn't been on Democracy Now! And so, it's very, very disappointing, you know, that, you know, these so-called, you know, folks on the left and, you know, many of which, you know, the so-called, you know, white left has, you know, seems to see that, you know, violence and war and this aggression that has been carried out. And I don't give a damn if the U.S. didn't declare what they're doing in Libya as a war. It is a war. It is a war. It's a war on them, you know. Yeah. So it's a war on Libya and the people there. And so, I don't give a damn if the U.S. declares that or not. I mean, it's a war of aggression. And, and for anyone on the left to think that this, knowing what you know about the U.S. government's, you know, military and its role as an imperialist force throughout the globe and its historic role as an imperialist force, destabilizing nations and bombing nations into oblivion, all in its own conquest and using it to, because it doesn't like, a socialist government to prop up here or there. Why the hell would you think it is justified to you can't come back to the table. I'm sorry. Like those folks who have thought it was justified for the U.S. to do this, you cannot come back to the table after this is over and start speaking out against the U.S. military. The military expenditure and the military doing this and that. You cannot come back to the table and eat with the rest of them. I'm sorry. Go ahead and form your own fact. You simply cannot, because what was done there, based on another pack of lies, exaggerating what is going on the ground. And it's just interesting, Andre, as you can see, they pick and choose. They pick and choose exactly where they want to so-called intervene. And when the U.S. says intervene, 9 times out of 10, it's bad news for people on the ground. It's bad news. And so it's just really interesting, and I hope folks think about it. And maybe this is something that we might even, briefly touch on with Brother Beku and Brother Obi when they come on the program. But, Andre, while we're on this topic, I wanted to talk to you about something that's coming up this Sunday. Today was, it was unveiled, and official dedications on Sunday, and already folks know about what I'm saying, what I'm talking about. I'm talking about the Martin Luther King Jr. Memorial in Washington, D.C. And what is interesting, and it's just I don't know how I get on this list, but I get these emails, Andrea, these lists, and from folks talking about this is the official MLK week, and let's go to the park, let's go to this club, let's go to Love. I mean, I've gotten the emails today, like, yo, so such and such, Club Love in D.C. and this club and such is having the official MLK dedication week kickoff. Come on out tomorrow. Yeah, it shouldn't be a surprise to anybody. It shouldn't be a surprise. It's definitely not you. It should be infuriating. But beyond that, this is leading up, Andre, as I was telling you off air, this is leading up to this week, this weekend. What a crock of crap that this Sunday is going to represent. And I tell you this with all uncertainty, that Dr. King is a man that I hold to the highest, reverence for his work, and using SCLC as a tool, to launch things like Operation Breadbasket and the Poor People's Campaign. And unfortunately, he was unable to see the launching of the erecting of Resurrection City. But, his ability to speak truth to so-called power, speaking in favor of, of social justice and against social injustice, the wars. And, Andre, all these things that I'm naming right now, the man, as we know, spoke, referred to, excessive materialism and militarism and racism as the triplets, that are plaguing America, referred to the U.S. government as the greatest purveyor of violence on the face of the earth. Injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere, okay? We heard all this stuff. This comes from Dr. King. And what is the hypocrisy of it is you're going to see President Barack Obama, President of the United States of America, who has expanded the war in Afghanistan, who has sent in drones into Pakistan, into Afghanistan, that have killed civilians, who initiated this campaign, this military campaign of aggression in Libya, who has done all these things, who is backed by the banks, all these things, and backed by the banks, which we're talking about, might as well talk about Dr. King, too. Dr. King said, what, any nation that spends more on military instead of programs of social uplift is headed for spiritual doom. Well, we know the U.S. spends much more on military than it does on programs of social uplift. All right? So, Andrea, what does it say? What does it say that all these people, they're expecting 250,000 people there to go there and to for this dedication to have folks like Obama speaking at it and all these like fake ass members of Congress, some of which are in the CBC, the Congressional Black Caucus, actors, entertainers, they're going to be dropping these crocodile tears. And Andrea, wouldn't you know that some of these folks are the ones that voted for appropriations for these wars? Some of them have voted, like, you know, Donna Edwards has supported Libya. And these folks are going to be there dropping these crocodile tears. And you're going to have folks out there lapping it up. Because why? Because so many Americans have no historical perspective whatsoever. So their take on Dr. King is what the mainstream America has given them, the mainstream educational systems and the mainstream, what else, mainstream media has given them. So when we hear Dr. King, what do we hear? You know, I dream of a world where, you know, where my four daughters will be judged on the content of their character and not the color of their skin. And that, it stopped there, and it stopped almost as if he died in 63. But will you hear some quotes saying Dr. King also said, you know, greatest purveyor of violence on the face of the earth is my own government, the U.S. government. In 2011, that's still true. They're not going to be talking about that, Andrea. They're not going to be talking about that in any shape, form, or fashion. And it is disgusting. And I'll end on this. I'll get your take on it. I'll end on this. What is so, so interesting, Andrea, is you have these folks that will be there. And people, if you're listening right now, if I'm ruffling your feathers, then you need to snap out of it then. If this is something new to you, you need to snap out of it. I think that most of our listeners right now are probably more in the agreement with us because most of our listeners are pretty radical and to the left as is. But maybe somebody listening right now, if it ruffles your feathers, then you need to do your homework on Dr. King. Don't be throwing out his name in this, that, and the other if you're not about his ideologies and his philosophies. Because these people that are going to be there on the 28th, these luminaries and these politicians, they are about nothing. They are have no principle. They are spineless. They are gutless. They are frauds of the highest caliber. Frauds. Fraudulent individuals. And they don't give a damn about his legacy because his legacy is about ending these kind of wars that exist right now that the U.S. is behind. His legacy was about ending institutional racism. His legacy was not about supporting corporations and this, that, and the other. His legacy was about supporting unions, and we see the attack on unions and poor people in this country as that we haven't seen in over a generation. It is despicable. It is despicable, and these folks need to be called out to the highest degree. So you know what, Andrea? I'm not going to be there on the 28th because you know what? The best thing that those of us that really want to honor his legacy can do, the best thing that we can do to honor his legacy is the work that we've been doing. The work that we do in the community, the work that we do on this program, the work that some of you listening right now are doing. I know there are people listening right now that are doing great work organizing around police brutality, organizing around poor people, organizing around, you know, stopping vile corporations like Walmart from moving in. That is the work that you should be doing, organizing against ending militarism as we know it. But you can't play both sides of the fence. You cannot play both sides of the fence. You simply can't. You can't be anti-U.S. military wars of aggression and at the same time be supporting this crap here. But these folks are spineless, and the reason they can be there on the 28th is because they're spineless and they know that most people have no historical perspective, so they can go there and they will have no basis. Andre, what is your opinion?
I want to highlight some of the sponsors of the memorial, them, the major contributors, so that people can reflect on what this is really about. We have Boeing, the corporation that makes military defense supplies, such as the Apache helicopter and a number of other types of helicopters. GE,
they're a military contractor.
Exactly. ExxonMobil, McDonald's, and people might wonder why I'm saying McDonald's, and the reason is that we know that all we find in poor Black and Latino neighborhoods is McDonald's and other corporations similar to McDonald's who feed our children poison and have no other no healthy alternative to for food. And so that's what causes the high rates of diabetes and blood pressure and obesity in Black and brown communities, you know, regardless of what white nutritionist. Huh?
Coca-Cola is a sponsor, too.
Yep, Coca-Cola, the union-busting corporation in the U.S. and one of the largest corporations in Colombia that kills union organizers. What else? It's just, it's all corporations. Comcast, Aetna, Fannie Mae, Merrill Lynch, the Lehman Brothers.
Yep.
Oh, Bank of America.
Yeah.
Hmm.
Aren't
those
Viacom.
All the ones that cause
yeah.
this? Viacom, BET. Aren't these all like corporations that caused the crisis in 2008 that were giving out loans to working class people? And you know, and just not, you know, trying to trick people to take these loans so they could make an extra buck. Shell. Yep. So if this is really about Dr. King's legacy, then, or if that's what people choose to believe, you can just look at the sponsors and realize what this is really about, because none of those corporations have any within their mission or what they do that is in sync with Dr. King's life or in what he did. And I think that, you know, it speaks for itself.
Right. It's, it's disgusting. And, it just is. You know, I mean, you hit it right on, you hit the nail right on the head. And it's, J.P. Morgan, I mean, and folks, I mean, you can go, you know, to, you know, buildthedream.org and just list, you know, there's a page that lists, you know, major contributors. And that's a place where you can find, you know, the major contributors. And, it's repugnant. I mean, it really is. And, Andre, I mean, I just can't emphasize the spineless people that are going to be there. I mean, it's going to be so disgusting. I mean, to see this procession of clowns out there, you know, just out there crying these crocodile tears. You know, you're going to have actors, entertainers, you know, folks that just don't that wouldn't know the first thing about speaking out. I mean, to bit them in the face. I mean, with every opportunity they have to speak out, they choose the option to stick with their corporate sponsors, because they don't want to lose their corporate sponsorship. They don't want to lose their corporate sponsorship. But, you know what I'm saying? It's a fad. It's like the, you know, the white teenager that wants to, you know, pick up the Che Guevara shirt and just wear that without knowing anything about what Che Guevara is about. It's just put on, man. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
It's just put on. But, oh, I'm supposed to believe you're some kind of, like, radical because you're wearing that? Because you're copying somebody else that was wearing it. I mean, it really is, you know. And you know, like, do we really think that if he was alive today, if Dr. King was alive today, do we really honestly think that he would be invited to the White House? He would be labeled as some crazy black, like, charlatan, crazy dude, the same way they try to, like, you know. Label Jeremiah Wright, but, you know, if you're a black guy speaking out, you know what I'm saying, you have any kind of prominence in a major city or nationwide, man, they're not going to ask you to come on to be a guest. They're just going to soundbite you and just, you know, they'd be doing the same thing if he was alive today, the same damn thing. So, you know, it's folks, you know, you need to call these folks out, you know, for what they are. They're a bunch of frauds. They're a bunch of frauds. They are not about anything. They're about power and greed, and they rely on you know, you Americans, you know, not knowing a damn thing about what Dr. King's life was all about. So, you know, so anyways, I am happy to welcome our guests on the program. I'm extremely happy to invite on our program a good friend of mine, my comrade, brother Obi Egbuna. He's been on this program many times before, and he'll be on this program many times after. And his reputation really precedes him. And as I said before at the beginning of the show, he is the U.S. correspondent to Zimbabwe's national newspaper, which is the Herald. And he's just done a range of work within the community. He's done work in El Salvador. And, you know, we're going to talk about a range of things with him. He's a playwright as well. We're going to get into a lot of different things. But also we're going to be joined very momentarily by Brother Abeku Dada, who, as I said before at the beginning of the show, he is the son of the civil rights icon, Mukasa Dada, formerly known as Willie Ricks. And as you know, he, along with Kwame Ture, some of you may know him as Stokely Carmichael, but Kwame Ture, they popularized the slogan Black Power, you know, amongst, you know, 60 generation, you know, radicals and activists. And, you know, we're going to be joined by him and talking about the work that he's doing with this organization, the Organization of African Doctors, which is a Pan-Africanist medical brigade that was established in Cuba, and its primary aim is to eliminate the brain drain in the arena of health at home. And when we're talking about home, we're talking about home. We're talking about on the continent of Africa and throughout the African diaspora, the Caribbean, and so forth. And this is going to be a strong show. And so without further ado, I would like to welcome on these two brothers, these two comrades to the program right now. Are you with us?
Yes, sir.
Yes. Yeah. How you doing, Sam?
I'm pretty good. It's nice to hear your voice again, Obi. I think I just heard it last night. It's always nice to hear your voice.
Yeah, always a pleasure.
Definitely. And welcome to you, Brother Abeku Dada. Thank you for coming on the program.
Thank you.
All right. And I'll let Andrea start off with a line of questioning that is going to be aimed at you, Brother Abeku.
Okay.
Brother Abeku Dada, can you please share how the Organization of African Doctors was created?
Okay, well, the Organization of African Doctors, we're basically a student organization of 160 students, interns, residents trained in Cuba. They represent more than 35 countries. When I'm a student at the Latin American School of Medicine. I got to the Latin American School of Medicine in 2009, and when I arrived there, I was accompanied by, Africans from all over the world, from the Quilombos in Brazil. I met Africans from the interiors in Suriname and all over the Caribbean, from Trinidad, from St. Lucia, St. Vincent, St. Kitts, Jamaica. We even had Africans in Latin America. We have one Bolivian. I met some people who I really idolized, the Garifuna people in Honduras. I met some Africans from Honduras who still got their own African culture, own African religion, and still got they're still tied to their African Africa. They're still tied to Africa. And I met Africans from Africa, from Kenya, from Ghana. I met Africans from Guinea-Conakry, from Guinea-Bissau, from Cabo Verde, even from African countries I never heard of, like Seychelles, and I never heard of Sao Tome and Principe. I never heard of Comoros. I met Africans from these countries, and even Cabo Verde, I never heard of that until this year. And I also met Africans from the Pacific Islands. I met Africans from Solomon Islands, which had this country had a revolution similar to Cuba. They had a coconut revolution. And the United States put an embargo on them, and they used coconut to survive. They made everything they need from coconuts, from gas, petroleum, to everything they need. So I met with all these students, and we came together, and I thought, hey, Kwame Ture said, we need to get organized. So I noticed that the in 2008 and 2007 and a couple years before us, they had programs, you know, but the people were never really organized. So we came together and we made it official and formed the Organization of African Doctors, and that's where it started, 2009, and it started in Havana, Cuba, in La Habana, Cuba, and we came together and we wanted to propose to create a different type of doctor, a doctor with high levels of discipline, high levels of consciousness, high levels of dedication, a dedicated doctor. We wanted to develop a different type of doctor. So that's how we started.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just saying that is how we started in 2009 at the Latin American School of Medicine, and we just wanted to figure out how we're going to develop a different type of doctor, and we just got organized and put a name on it, and that's it.
What made you want to attend the medical school at Latin America in Cuba?
What made me go to the Latin American School of Medicine in Cuba?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Oh, man. Well, I could have went to a school here. But I thought about it. I said, I think I want to learn medicine from a socialist point of view, from an international point of view, you know. And I heard of it was an international program. So I said, I think I might want to check this out. And if I don't like it, I come back here and go to school. So I heard about the program. It was free. As a youngster, I always heard about it because I was doing homeschool, so I was at home with my father all day, every day. And I studied and I learned, and he helped me learn a lot of things. And we always used to go to different colleges. Like, we'd go to Morehouse College in Atlanta, and we'll walk through the campus, and I heard a lot of Black Power. I heard them making people say Black Power. I remember in school, in elementary school, we used to have to walk down the hall with our finger on our mouth, and no one can talk, but he made all the kids say Black Power anyway. And I remember we going to the colleges, and he'd make all the kids say Black Power. So I said, okay, Black Power. And then I hear him telling the students, Cuba give out full scholarships to medical school. But I'm 7, 8, 9, 10, 13 years old. I didn't really pay attention. And when I finally graduated from college, I tried to figure out what I'm going to do. And I knew I always excelled in math and science, so I wanted to do something in that field. So I chose the Latin American School of Medicine because I've been hearing about it so long. And it seems so surreal, medical school for free, and you study in Cuba, and they pay you, and they give you everything you need, from toothbrush to lab coats to shoes, everything. It seems so surreal. So I went down there, I checked it out, and we got organized as a people, and we organized ourselves and formed the Organization of African Doctors. Mm-hmm.
Can you discuss a little bit the impact of the brain drain on Africa, the Caribbean, and Latin America?
Okay, yes. Well, that's one of our missions at the Organization of African Doctors, because we represent the unification of African students and professionals of medicine, and medical professions, whether it be nurses or doctors. But we represent the unification of all of the medical professionals that are African people, or that's willing to address the situation of African people. And, you know, our mission is to develop programs and projects and institutions, you know, to help our people. And we thought about it, you know, when we go back to these different communities, we always notice that either it's a community where the African people are poor and they don't have health care, or we go to a community where there's no orthodox medicine, where there's no Western medicine in the community, and the people are solely dependent on traditional medicine. Now, the brain drain, this situation, we look all over the world and we have students studying medicine. We have students studying, we have students using their brain, being architects, studying astronomy, mathematicians, scientists, all over the world that they're studying in their countries. And they leave their country and they come to the European, the country, the European country that speaks their language. So if it's Ghana, they may go to Europe or United States. So if it's Angola, they may go to Portugal to practice. And the problem is that people are leaving their communities and going to other going to European countries to use their expertise to work and use their brain. So the problem is we don't have our African doctors in our community. You know, we don't, like, if you look at Ghana, for example, out of every 10 doctors that are made in Ghana, they leave Ghana and they come to the United States or they go to Europe. So why are they leaving home? Why are we leaving home? You know, why are the African people leaving their communities and coming to America or going to Europe to practice? That's the problem that we have with the brain drain. And it's also, it started with slavery too. Brother Luther Castillo, Garifuna brother that returned home to his community and built a hospital, he was telling us about the extraction of human resources from Africa during slavery. When they came to Africa and they stole millions of us from Africa, they stole all the human resources from Africa. When we leave Africa, the human resources, Africa is rich in natural resources, but the human resources are leaving Africa. And, you know, we need the human resources to cultivate the land. We need the human resources. We need the brains of the humans. We need us to be the doctors, to build, to organize, you know, and build. So the brain drain is basically, we're giving our brain to America, and they're giving us money in return, and we're using our expertise. And they, you know, all of our brain is basically in their hands. So it's basically making America better, making Europe better, and Africa is stuck with no brain. So
Go ahead. Oh no, go on. I'm sorry. No, finish, please.
I'm finished. I was just saying they're robbing us of our brains. That's all they're doing, and that's why the Organization of African Doctors, we have objective of unification and organization and building consciousness so our brothers and sisters can notice. So training ourselves, you know, self development, services, building brigades to go back home to these communities. You know, and reverse the brain drain and bring Africans back home, what we call the brain gain. Academic excellence, because, you know, the brain is taking your brain, and academics is the key to, you know, becoming a doctor, you know, academic excellence. So we promote academic excellence, and we have many other missions, but them are a few of our missions. We want to return African, one of them, which is very significant, is the building services for our people, you know, reversing the brain drain to a brain gain, you know, building conscious doctors, young, because the students that we're studying, we're 21, 20, 17, 18, 19 years old, we're learning. So we're trying to, you know, develop serious, dedicated, conscious doctors that's going to be ready to reverse the brain drain to brain gain and return African doctors, return the African brain back to the African community.
Right on. I'm no more speechless, brother. I really appreciate what you had to say, and to see a young brother like yourself doing what you're doing, you know, going to the Latin American School of Medicine, and, you know, you're going to be contributing your talents, and already are contributing your talents, but after you're formally a doctor, going to be giving back your talents to Mother Africa and her people. I commend you, and a lot of folks, so-called, you know, leaders and activists everywhere from Capitol Hill throughout the nation, you know, need to be you know, following the lead that that you and your comrades have set forth. So I really thank you for your words and your insight. I just want to kind of shift, if I may, shift to Brother Obi, and I want to get your insight on a couple of things. And Obi, before I even get to the nitty gritty of things I want to ask you, you have, you know, to a lot of reactionaries who hear you speak for the first time at conferences, on panels, they like to put you in a box as if, you know, all of your work has been around Zimbabwe. Yes, you've done some tremendous work around Zimbabwe, and there's much more work to do because, you know, we need to rip these sanctions to shreds. But, you know, to make sure that you're not remembered for somebody who has only done work around Zimbabwe, can you give us an overview about your work dealing with Cuba? And
oh,
you can finish by talking about the Zimbabwe-Cuba Friendship Association.
Sure. Most definitely. Well, as always, Solomon, thank you so much for having us on. And I would just like to begin by saying that, first of all, we know that when we take a look at the Cuban Revolution, on a Pan-African scale, we have numerous points of reference, because when we talk about these points of reference, we have to talk about our inspirations. For some people, it could be Kwame Nkrumah, because Kwame Nkrumah and the Convention People's Party were the first country in the world to recognize the Cuban Revolution after the Batista regime was overthrown in 1959. For some people, it could be Assata Shakur, because since 1979, she's been there safe, completely safe. For some people, it could be Malcolm X, because of we are 51 years removed from the historic meeting between Malcolm X and Fidel Castro at the Hotel Teresa in Harlem, New York, when Fidel led the first delegation as the president of Cuba here to the United States for the United Nations General Assembly at the time. It could be Marcus Garvey, because at the height of the UNIA, they had 50 chapters inside the UNIA. It could be Frantz Fanon, because Che Guevara fell in love with The Wretched of the Earth and insisted that the book be translated in Spanish. It could be Miri Baraka, because of Cuba Libre, the essay that he wrote. There are numerous references. But I would like to think, moving into the future, that what Abeku Dada has done in Cuba with the Organization of African Doctors becomes a point of reference just as important, just as critical, just as inspiring as what those people did long before him. So, I want to say that I'm privileged to have been in his living room in 2003, 8 years ago, when his father and I had the first serious conversation with him about him considering attending the Latin American School of Medical Sciences. And I've known him since he was 4 years old, and words can't describe how inspired I am of him, by him, and how in awe I am of him. And I'm just so glad to be working with him on the projects that he's talking about. But in terms of my small contributions to the issue of Cuba, in 2003, 8 years ago, we convinced the Cuban Intersection in Washington, D.C. An intersection, for your listeners that don't understand what that is, it has the same makeup and composition as an embassy. But when you don't have normalized relations with a country, you have an interest section instead, and it does the same thing that an embassy would do. It's a networking and information outlet to talk about the attributes of your country. And we convinced them to start celebrating an African Liberation Day reception as a vehicle to mobilize the African community so we can intensify our efforts to defend the sovereignty and integrity of the Cuban Revolution inside the United States borders. That was one thing. In 2005, we organized a group of local poets together on July 26th to have a poetry slam, a poetry tribute to Cuba, and we organized that program again on October 8th in commemoration of the assassination of Che Guevara, the 38th anniversary of that. And that's something that we definitely need to get back to doing. That same year, we convinced the United Church of Christ, Plymouth Congregational Church, under the leadership of Pastor Grayland Ellis Hegler, to have a prayer breakfast dealing with how the church community can play a role in lifting the blockade on Cuba. In 2004, right after the travel restrictions were imposed on the Cuban diplomats inside Washington, D.C., They cannot go outside the Beltway anywhere in the United States when they're invited. So they were invited to the Methodist Church National Convention in Hagerstown, Maryland, and they could not go, and the first secretary, Alberto Prieto at the time, asked me to go and represent Cuba at the convention, and I went, and I gave a presentation about what our generation can do to continue the legacy of Cuban solidarity. On their behalf, in 2003, I debated Ambassador Dennis Hayes, one of the spokespeople for the Cuban American National Foundation, which was created in 1983 at the behest of Ronald Reagan in Miami to create a public relations component of the terrorist cells in Miami that are responsible for the 638 assassination attempts on the life of Comandante Fidel Castro. And I helped organize the last delegation that the Cuban diplomats had outside the Beltway to Atlanta, Georgia, the same weekend that Jimmy Carter became the first president since Calvin Coolidge to go to Cuba in 2003. So those are some of the things that I've done. In relationship to the Zimbabwe-Cuba Friendship Association, I was asked to join that by Ambassador Cosme Torres Espinosa, who at the time was the Cuban ambassador to Zimbabwe. Ambassador Torres is now on the Africa desk in Cuba, in Havana. He is the highest ranking Cuban diplomat to ever be deported from the United States in 2003 under false charges of espionage. And when I went home to Cuba, I found out he was there. My first stop in Zimbabwe was to the Cuban embassy to let him know I was there, to let him know that I would be there for a significant amount of time. And he insisted that I join that organization and assist with that organization. The Zimbabwe-Cuba Friendship Association was set up to maintain the people-to-people solidarity between the people of Zimbabwe and the people of Cuba. The reason that Zimbabwe has a 97% literacy rate today is because Cuba began training the teachers in Zimbabwe as early as 1983. And this is how that relationship, and for those who hear about Cuba's relationship to the African continent, the white left deliberately magnifies the relationship between Fidel Castro and Nelson Mandela. And one would think that Nelson Mandela is the only African head of state to have been a recipient of the Jose Marti Award, which was the highest political honor one can receive in Cuba. Nelson Mandela is the third African president to receive that distinction. The first was our late warrior Thomas Sankara out of Burkina Faso. He got it in 1984. And in 1985, President Robert Gabriel Mugabe of the Republic of Zimbabwe was the recipient of that award. And that was a very significant act on behalf of the Cuban people, because at the height of the Cold War, during the Patriotic United Front, you had ZANU and ZAPU, and Cuba, being part of the Soviet bloc, backed Joshua Nkomo and ZAPU, not President Mugabe and ZANU. So when Fidel extended that overture to President Mugabe, it shattered the myth that Fidel was a puppet of the Soviet Union and did not act independently of the Soviet Union politically, did not act independent of the Soviet Union militarily. So those are just some of the things that in the space and time I've occupied Earth, in the 21 years I've been on the front line fighting for the liberation of African people, the liberation of the African continent, the unification of the African continent, I've been blessed to contribute to the Cuban Revolution.
Right. Ovi, can you give us a backdrop of these sanctions that have been imposed on Zimbabwe, and also can you compare and contrast the impact of these sanctions in comparison to what a war, the kind of death and destruction that a war with military arms brings? Because I've heard you talk about that, you know, some of us have this G.I. Joe mentality that think that wars are the only thing that impact the people.
Cuba's the excellent backdrop for that, because we have 638 assassination attempts on the life of Fidel Castro since 1959 that U.S. imperialism is responsible for. But Fidel Castro will tell you without equivocation, without apology, that the blockade on Cuba that has cost them $97 billion that could have gone towards their free health care, gone towards their free education, gone towards their efforts to do everything they can to make their society rock solid in every basic area, since they believe the human resource is the most important resource, Zimbabwe is under the same type of sanctioning. For too long now, we've allowed ourselves to march to the beat of the white left's drum on the question of military repression and violence. We have to see bombs, we have to see guns, we have to see classic traditional warfare before we even mobilize ourselves, before we even organize ourselves, before we even strategize on the highest qualitative level possible. And we have to get out of that habit. And we do not want Zimbabwe to be in the same predicament that Cuba is in, where next year the blockade that Kennedy imposed in 1962 turns 50 years old. That's the 50th anniversary that we should not be celebrating, but it's one that we should admit that because we've been casual, that blockade is still in place. The whole planet is against that monstrous policy, but that isolationist policy, that genocidal policy, that fascist policy, but yet that policy is still intact because the pressure inside U.S. borders has been casual. And the same thing come December, the Zimbabwe Democracy Economic Recovery Act of 2001 turns 10 years old. And the fact that the Congressional Black Caucus voted almost unanimously for this monstrous policy, that should get people inspired to want to do something. The fact that we know it's a tradition in our community, it's almost, attacking Republicans in the African community is almost as much of a tradition as fireworks on the 4th of July or turkeys or Thanksgiving. But for some reason, when Ronald Wilson Reagan decided to sabotage the Lancaster House Agreement of 1979, where it was agreed by Jimmy Carter and Margaret Thatcher that the land would be transferred back to the Zimbabwean people between 1980 and 1990, Reagan comes in and says he's not going to honor the agreement. And ironically, what became the most politically in vogue thing to do in connection to African developments on the African continent was to get yourself arrested in the South African embassy. Jesse Jackson ran for president twice, 1984 and 1988. We had a million-man march where they say an estimated 2 million people showed up on the mall. Many significant activities have been organized. Many significant, and look at the organizations we have that every year, like clockwork, have their annual symposiums or their annual conventions. The NAACP has one. Rainbow Coalition has one. The Provisional Government of the Republic of New Africa has Nations Day. The All African People's Revolutionary Party, the African People's Socialist Party have African Liberation Day. We look all across our community and you see all of these events. And at no point, if we go back and research, there were very few times, if any at all, that platforms were afforded to raise that issue that Reagan must honor the Lancaster House Agreement. And then when Reagan exited from the scene, then Bush Sr. should have honored the agreement, and then Clinton should have honored the agreement. So we dropped the ball in relationship to that. So our efforts to intensify the struggle to get these sanctions lifted are correcting a mistake that was made by the previous generations, where for whatever sets of reason, because Zimbabwe was not under military attack, Zimbabwe was not under siege militarily, we have this tendency to diminish the value of diplomatic warfare, the dangers of diplomatic warfare, rather. And especially since we have a president in the White House now who tells you that we must understand that the might of our military must be matched by the strength of our diplomacy, which translates in simple English, if I can't bomb you, I have no problem starving you to death.
Right, right. Obi, you and Brother Beko are on the verge of submitting two historical appeals to the mm-hmm. African Union as well as the U.S. government mm-hmm. simultaneously. Can you talk about them and also give a backdrop about, in regards to the Zimbabwe question on HIV/AIDS and the progress that Zimbabwe mm-hmm. has made around that, that issue?
No problem at all. There are two very historic appeals, and we have a nice core group of frontline fighters who are Baku and I, not alone, that are doing this. And as the U.S.-based member of the Zimbabwe-Cuba Friendship Association, I'm just honored to be able to help put this together. There are two appeals. One of them is going to the African Union. And 10 years ago, Fidel Castro made an offer to Africa that he was willing to deploy 4,000 of Cuba's best HIV/AIDS doctors, researchers, and specialists to be dispersed throughout the African continent where they are needed. At a moment in history where we have 21 million AIDS orphans on the African continent, should I repeat that? 21 million AIDS orphans, we're simply appealing to the conscience of the African Union, saying that we would like to see them pool their resources and wealth together to bring that brigade home to Africa. Bring that brigade home to Africa. And that's not a stretch for them, because they are already 3,000 Cuban doctors dispersed throughout Africa. I've had the honor and privilege of spending quality time with the 130 that are in Zimbabwe, and their work is nothing short of breathtaking. Their living accommodations are the equivalent of a dormitory on a college campus. And they're what the Chinese call barefoot doctors. And when they're not in the hospitals administering care to people in need for free, they are in the medical schools teaching. Because one of the goals of Cuba is to build a central medical school on the African continent. But until they complete that objective, they will, their medical brigades will teach in the schools, trying to convince those students who are the recipients of their training, the recipients of the orientation that Abeku so eloquently described, they will sign an agreement to stay in their countries and not go to the country of their former colonial master. So this is what, and Fidel Castro first shared this with Kofi Annan 10 years ago, and he asked the United Nations assist, and they, of course, said they did not have the resources to do it. So all of these churches that we have, all of these business people that we have who send financial contributions back to Africa because of their genuine concern about genocide in the form of HIV/AIDS, they can also look at the possibility of financing this brigade. They definitely need to be on the African continent. They are so desperately needed. And the Cuban doctors are already helping. And Cuba, what qualifies Cuba is because of the fact that Cuba has the lowest HIV/AIDS rate in the world, for people who did not know that. What qualifies Cuba? Cuba also has the best gerontology program in the world. For people that don't know what gerontology is, that's an area of medicine that deals with the elderly. And we know that that's one of the weakest areas in terms of medical dynamics in Africa, is the inadequate gerontology strategic planning. Cuba, this will enable them to do that also for people who are older who have contracted the virus. So the ramifications of this are extremely significant. And may I remind people that Fidel Castro always never hesitates to tell people, and Raul Castro has been doing it since he's taken over, that they consider the Cuban doctors the greatest army they've ever assembled, greater than the army that fought off the Spanish. Wow. And between 1868 and 1890, and what is known in U.S. textbooks as the Spanish-American Revolution, greater than the army that fought shoulder to shoulder with MPLA in Cueto Cuneable in Angola for 14 years, greater than the army that went to Guinea-Bissau and assisted Amilcar Cabral and the Party for Independence of Guinea and Cape Verde, greater than the army that was ready to go and take down Mobutu Seseko, the godfather of military neocolonialism on the African continent. So the fact that they have that level of commitment, that's the African component. And we know for many people, whenever you talk about the African continent, some of us just instinctively respond, well, what about off the continent? So what we have to say to them is, we didn't forget Babylon. We are sending an appeal simultaneously to the Obama administration that we want Cuban doctors in three. Number one, on Native American reservations, because this is our way of showing tribute to the Native Americans, because when Africans write their history and we talk about slavery, when you when you weren't hiding in the closet or the basement of an abolitionist, the only other place you could be safe inside U.S. borders was on the Native American reservation. And they were making us chiefs, honorary chiefs of their distinguished nations. So it can be argued that the Native Americans were part and parcel of the Underground Railroad. So this is our way for showing giving our thanks to them for keeping us safe, which played a very critical role in our resolve. Then secondly, we want the Cuban doctors to be positioned in infirmaries, in prisons, where people are left to die like flies every day. And there's no plan to do anything about this. And, of course, thirdly, we want to see Cuban doctors housing the hospitals, the public hospitals and clinics that are being shut down throughout the United States because of the health care crisis, starting with D.C. General Hospital. Because in Southeast Washington, D.C., which is 98% African, there's no level one trauma center. There's no prenatal care unit. And the closest hospitals are George Washington and Washington Hospital Center. So if you're shot, if you're stabbed, if you get in a fatal car accident, you're not going to make it. So we are saying that that's where we would like them to go first. And this is a tribute to Booker T. Washington and W.E.B. Du Bois. Booker T. Washington, for people who don't know, had started Negro Help Month in this country. And because his benefactors felt that was too nationalist coming from him, they insisted that he stop that. And then eventually Du Bois, in 1904, I believe, wrote a powerful journal called The Psyche and Health of the Negro American, where he was raising the point that from chattel slavery to 1904, our relationship to health care had not changed one bit. And the reason, and we want those doctors here. And this is not just something that we started. In 2005, I stood in front of City Hall in New York City with Councilman Charles Barron and Mutulu Olubala, also known as M1 of the internationally acclaimed hip-hop group Dead Prez. And we stood there 45 days before Hurricane Katrina, and we asked for Cuban doctors to come to New York City. We asked for them to come all over the country. And what ended up happening is, of course, during Hurricane Katrina, the humanitarian, compassionate overture of the Cuban government was drowned out by Kanye West's punchline about George W. Bush. This is not to criticize him. It wasn't his fault. He was speaking, he was articulating the sentiments of our community, no question. But we allowed mainstream media, we allowed the academicians in our community, the preachers in our community, the journalists in our community, the elected officials in our community, to magnify that one sentence, as opposed to focusing on the fact that Fidel Castro said that 1,500 of Cuba's best environmental disaster specialists were ready at a moment's notice to come to New Orleans, to come to the Gulf region. And he said they would not only be there after they weathered the storm, but they would be there until the health infrastructure in those in that respective area of the United States had been totally resurrected. And for people who know anything about that area, those are the two worst public hospitals in the country, the one that was in New Orleans and the one that was in Mississippi, that was destroyed during the process. And the United States did not say no. They simply ignored the overture. He originally offered 500 of his best disaster specialists, but then he called the next day, 48 hours later, and said, we've got 1,500 for you. And while everyone was focused on Katrina, you can count the articles written, you can count the radio shows that were done, you can count the television shows that were done, you can count the town hall meetings that were done, and I guarantee you that it would be compared to a whisper. And we dropped the ball. So what this does is this gives us the opportunity to say that we want them on U.S. soil and we're willing to fight for them to come on U.S. soil. And the other thing, and I could care less what the implications are for me as an individual, because one of the biggest honors of my life is when I was told that my contract was not continued at Bowie State University. I received a phone call from the Public Safety Division 2 weeks later telling me that the FBI was up there inquiring about me, even though I wasn't working there anymore. And when I had an attorney contact the agent, because I wasn't going to talk to the agent about anything, the reason that they were checking up on me is because of my frequent visits to the Cuban intersection on 16th Street in Washington, D.C. So this whole effort, this whole push, and we are tired of the Democrats exploiting our sentiments, exploiting our anger, exploiting our frustration. John Conyers has been calling for universal health care before he had gray hair. And we know his obedience to the Democratic Party. I would argue he's a better Democrat than he is a Christian, a better Democrat than he is a parent or grandparent. Not to say he's not a good grandparent, not to say he's not a good parent, but I guarantee you he's put more time into helping the Democratic Party than he has his own family under his own roof. And look how they treat him, like a nigger, like a message boy, like an errand boy, or Donna Christensen, the health liaison of the Black Caucus. Anytime they bring up health, or anytime the Congressional Black Caucus tries to deal with something around their through their health brain trust, it's treated as it's totally dismissed. The Black Nurses Association can't do this. The National Medical Association can't do this. The Student National Medical Association can't do this. So Abeku and I came together and said that using the Zimbabwe-Cuba Friendship Association for the African issue we want to raise, and using the Organization of African Doctors for what needs to be done in the diaspora as well as the continent, we're saying that we can do that, because if other people have decided that they would rather be grant eligible than historically responsible, that's okay. We'll do it for them. And too many times when we talk about Pan-Africanism, people talk about it as though it's an academic exercise. It must be driven by our activism, meaning that you must attach yourselves to the issues that have the most unifying potential. And this is also our way of saying thank you to Cuba. Thank you to Cuba for everything they've done for Africa. Thank you for Assad Shakur's safety. Thank you for defending Guinea-Bissau. Thank you for defending Angola. Thank you for making Zimbabwe Africa's most literate country. Thank you for everything we've done. But not just saying thank you to them, the gratitude needs to be demonstrated in our labor. And if we show people the humanitarian face of the Cuban Revolution, the humanitarian face of the Cuban and people, we know that that will be a catalyst to lift the blockade. We can't wait for the Democrats to do it. They're not going to do it. And then they'll use the Republicans as the excuse. They'll use the right-wing gusanos in Miami as an excuse. And we know they will use anything. Anyone on a social level, look at the movie Scarface. Scarface was an anti-Cuba movie. In the beginning, Tony Montana trashes the Cuban Revolution, and at the beginning of the movie, Fidel is speaking about the Marielistas on the boat lift. If you look at Godfather 2, for those of you who like mafia movies, that's a Cuban propaganda movie. So the propaganda against Cuba has been malicious for such a long time. And Africans who have benefited the most from Cuba's compassion, from Cuba's humanity, from Cuba's appetite for justice, we are the ones that have to make sure that that blockade is lifted. We can't let it become a thing where Obama, when he becomes preoccupied with how history remembers him, tries to make an overture. That must happen in the streets. That must happen from the bottom to the top. So in a way, so when we put the appeal out, there are many quality people who've already signed on to it, and we encourage other people to give support to it. Many people have signed on. John Boyd, the head of the National Black Farmers Alliance, has signed on. Dr. Malefi Asante has signed on. M1 Mutulu Olubala from Dead Prez has signed on. People in Guyana have signed on. People in the Virgin Islands have signed on. We're asking our comrades in Canada to sign on. Many quality people have already, a lot of people in Oakland have signed on because they're very familiar of Huey Newton and the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense connection to Cuba. So we're asking all of these people to sign on to this. This is an active effort. This is not a paper tiger by any stretch of the imagination. This is a practical way to say that we know that our most significant gains have come through grassroots political activism. The vote is not our only outlet of political expression, and we are tired of the Democratic Party making whores out of our issues when they feel that they can exploit them for political gain. They've been doing this for a long time. As a matter of fact, when we were burning down the streets of Washington, D.C. after Martin Luther King's assassination, Lyndon Johnson was watching from the White House window, and he rejoiced, saying, "Now I can push that fair housing bill I've been trying to push." So they don't care what it is. They will try to exploit our resistance for their benefit. But this issue of having Cuban doctors on U.S. soil, it's not to make the Democratic Party look good. It's not to scare the Republican Party. But it's to show you that we've been fighting for quality health care since the days of the slave shack. And we deserve it. It's our human right to have it. And we already know that many of the countries that Cuban doctors service are not politically, ideologically compatible with them. In 2003, I believe, either 2003 or 2004, the president of Honduras was with the United States in Geneva submitting a resolution attacking Cuba of human rights violations of their political opposition inside their country. At the same time that he was in Geneva doing that, his wife, the First Lady of Honduras, was in Cuba signing a pact for 7,000 doctors of Cuba to go to Honduras. So this is someone that's working to justify maintaining the blockade on Cuba, but the Cuban revolution still is ready to go to Honduras and treat the people of Honduras. Many people got to Haiti and were shocked. Cuba, Haiti's another point of reference for people because there are 500 doctors positioned in Haiti from Cuba that are there full time. And when the earthquake hit a year and a half ago, 400 Haitian students, Babeku probably knows some of them, were graduating from Cuba, from medical school in Cuba, and they walked off the stage and went right back to Haiti and went to work. And the 500 Cuban doctors who were on vacation joined them. So they went back into Haiti 900 doctors strong, ready to do the work of what a true doctor's supposed to do. And when we hear the accounts of Daniel Hale Williams, who performed the first open heart surgery in this country, despite racism, or Charles Drew, who died like a dog, who needed to be saved with his own invention of blood plasma. This is also a tribute to those people. This is also a working tribute to those people. And that's what we want to see done through our work.
If somebody wants to sign on to the appeal, how they do that?
All they have to do is email. They can just do it by email. obiegbuna15@gmail.com, and they can indicate how they'd like to be signed on, the name of the organization they represent, and what have you. And we're willing to come around. The Baker is about to go back to school, but M1 and I, this is connected to what we're doing also, because he's doing a CD on the blockade of Cuba and the sanctions on Zimbabwe, of course. So one of the things that we'll be talking about, and one of the follow-up things I want to do, Solomon, I'm working on it right now. It should be ready by the first week of January. I'm writing a play called Cuba's Greatest Army, and the play is about Cuba's medical brigade and Cuba's doctors as an act of gratitude and thanks to them for all the African lives that they've saved. So this is not to make a political statement in all actuality. It makes a political statement always, but this also makes a humanitarian statement. And this is helping Cuba, empowering Cuba to save African lives. Empowering Cuba to save African lives. That's all we want to do.
Right.
And we owe that to all the people who are in cemeteries tonight because they died in hospitals and on operating tables in the United States and on the African continent, under-resourced.
Without a doubt. Thank you for that. Obi, while we're on the discussion of, you know, your next play, well, actually, before I say that, a lot of folks may not know that for the last 21 years you have been serving as a teacher of African history in Roots Public Charter School in D.C. Mm-hmm. And early this year, you wrote a play entitled African Liberation Day for Our Children. And I know that I remember speaking to you before, and when you got back, you know, not only was it featured at Roots, but then you were invited to go down to Selma and Tuskegee, mm-hmm. where the play was performed there. You trained young people there.
Yeah.
Could you end this interview by talking about the play and other plays you'll be writing in the near future and how these plays
most definitely
serve as a platform to
our
work?
Thank you for bringing attention to the play. Yes, it's that play is a tribute to Kwame Ture. No activist in this country did more to promote the institutional framework of African Liberation Day since its inception in 1963 than Kwame Ture. So I just hope that wherever he is, he was watching, and I hope that that smile of his that we know him for, I hope he's smiling. I hope he was smiling when he saw it. Yes, they are 21 historical figures that play focuses on. Ida B. Wells. The first scene is between Ida B. Wells and Nahanda of Zimbabwe discussing the noose and discussing. There's a scene with Claudia Jones and Shirley Graham Du Bois, a scene with Kwame Ture and Ahmed Sekou Ture, who was one of the people he changed his name after. There's a scene with Malcolm and Martin, of course. There's a scene with Shirley Graham Du Bois and Claudia Jones, I said that. Both of Marcus Garvey's wives, both Amy Garveys, both Amy Ashwood Garvey and Amy Jock Garvey. There's a scene with Hazel Scott and Paul Robeson. And the play was just to take advantage of all frontline fighters have three areas of space that they must concentrate on: your generational space, your historical space, and your creative space. Your creative space is just looking at all outlets at your disposal to make frontline service and frontline resistance attractive, appealing, making people understand that it's not an option, it's an obligation. Historical space is having an appreciation for history and being historically responsible, and the generational space is maximizing your potential with your peers in your generation. And African Liberation Day enables us to do all of that, because African Liberation Day, at the core of African Liberation Day, is the African fighting spirit. We sometimes interpret our history, the interpretations of our history reek of victimization. If you're focusing on the civil rights movement, you show me Sheriff Jim Clark, Sheriff Bull Connor, George Wallace, Ross Barnett. The hell with them. Deacons for Defense, Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, Southern Christian Leadership Conference. Our resistance. If we focus on colonialism, we talk about, if it was Zimbabwe, people will talk about the viciousness of Ian Smith, the viciousness of Jeffrey Huggins. The hell with them. ZANU-PF whipping them. ZAPU whipping them. That's what we focus on. Don't focus on the bloodthirsty, vampire, cannibalistic nature of the Portuguese, arguably the most violent European colonialists we encountered. Focus on the PIGC and Guinea-Bissau whipping them on the battlefield. Frelimo and Mozambique whipping them on the battlefield. MPLA and Angola whipping them on the battlefield. That's what we focus on. So African Liberation Day enables us to do that. There were several points that the play makes. Number one, history did not begin in the 1960s, and it definitely isn't going to end in the 1960s. So there's a deliberate effort to focus on many activists who were on the scene before the 1960s. Also, we will have the last word on our history. So it was a deliberate attempt to highlight on many giant freedom fighters who have been written out of our history. Hazel Scott, for example, we should be talking about her in every living room tonight, because this year we celebrated the 25th anniversary of the Oprah Winfrey Show. Hazel Scott's the first African to have a TV show in the United States on NBC. But because of her marriage to Adam Clayton Powell, because of her ties to liberation movements in Africa, liberation movements in the Caribbean, because of her socialist orientation, she was taken off the air. So for people who complain about Oprah's outlook, Hazel Scott's the alternative. So too many times, and you know this as one of the best writers, if not the best writer, on hip-hop, the genre, in the 1990s, hip-hop began to show an infatuation and an obsession with La Cosa Nostra figures. Everyone was talking about Lucky Luciano or Maya Lansky or Vito Genovese or Carlo Gambino, whoever it was. And instead of getting frustrated about that, because we can understand the connection or the attraction, these are people who escape poverty. And because of so much emphasis on racism and us not dealing with capitalism to the degree we should, we think poverty is something that should be escaped anyway, not something that should be eliminated. So it's quite natural that we would gravitate to people who escape the cycle of poverty which capitalism creates. So we understood why they were attracted, but instead of bashing these artists, expose them to people. So if you don't like the way Little Kim dresses, talk to her about Ida B. Wells. If you don't like the way Jackie O dresses, talk to her about Shirley Graham Du Bois. This is what we're supposed to be doing. It's easy to magnify problems. It's more challenging to develop solutions to those problems. And to develop solutions to those problems, that's a full-time job. That's not a mood or emotion that you can just deal with whenever you feel like it. So the play, yes, African Liberation Day was an attempt. We did it at Roots for the recital. It was picked to be used for the annual recital piece, and it went very well. It went very well, and I was invited by the 21st Century Youth Leadership Movement. They have a camp, a history camp, and Alabama every year. So we put it on with kids in Selma, and we put it on in kids in Tuskegee. But we also met with some teachers that teach in the public school system throughout the state of Alabama who were looking at how theater can be used to infuse history and culture into the curriculum. And the play was chosen to examine. And so I've been invited to come back down there before the year is over and spend between 30 and 45 days there. Some people are interested in seeing the play in Canada, in Guyana, in the Virgin Islands, potentially Venezuela as well. So we just want to do it and just want to continue to do it. And it felt natural because it had an autobiographical feel to it, because I marched in my first African Liberation Day at the age of 9, right down the street from where I live now at Malcolm X Park in Washington, D.C., and that was the closest I felt to being in Africa since I'd been here. And at that point, I'd been in the United States for 3 years. And I felt like I was right in Nigeria, right in Enugu, or right in Ozobolo, just kicking it, being basic, being natural. And it felt real good. And so African Liberation Day has always guided me. And when I got immersed in Western popular culture for a little while, between the years, shall we say, of 1981 and 1986, I had an experience. I was stabbed in 1985, and when I was laying on the hospital bed, one of the things I was thinking about was the things I learned, the things I was fortunate enough to be exposed to, and that I had to do everything I could in my power to represent that tradition with integrity and being forthright when I did it. So African Liberation Day was my rites of passage. So I felt that exposing children to this at the earliest ages possible was the most selfless thing that I could try to do. Because sometimes we get very capitalist with information. We get information, we keep it to ourselves, our bookshelves are rich, our bookshelves are illustrious, but we don't share that information, and we deprive our children of it. And in this capitalist society, they tell you to feed the children's belly, feed the children's stomach. But what we are approaching is having a generation of kids with full stomachs but empty heads, and we cannot let that happen. So this is just a way to deal with that. Some of the other plays, I've written another one that will be done at some point called Bottled Up Genius and Anger, which deals with the juvenile justice system. I'm working on the one called Cuba's Greatest Army about the doctors, one about the sanctions in Zimbabwe called Zimbabwe Forever, Sanctions Never, and another one called War in the Classroom, which will be a tribute to all of the pioneers in the field of education who used the classroom as the platform to decolonize the African mind, deal with mental enslavement, if you will. So everybody from Charles Hamilton Houston, who taught Thurgood Marshall, who talked about the social engineer, from Sterling Brown to Julia Mayfield, Carter G. Woodson, many people are going to be in that play. As a matter of fact, President Mugabe will be, someone will play him in that play, because for many people who don't know, before President Mugabe joined the liberation struggle in Zimbabwe, he was a teacher at St. Mary's College in Takoradi, Ghana. And as a matter of fact, it was there that he met his first wife, Zimbabwe's first lady, Amai Sally Mugabe, who made her transition almost 20 years ago. And her being a Ghanaian, going into leaving independent Ghana, going into contested Rhodesia, who says the Underground Railroad stopped with Harriet Tubman and Levi Coffin? Nothing could be further from the truth. So these are some of the plays that will be done in the future.
All right. Obi, before we let you go, there's a question I want to ask you before we get off the air,
mm-hmm.
and it's something we covered the last time you were on Your World News,
mm-hmm.
and I'm just bringing it up because it's you know, it's been relevant, but, you know, here in the U.S., it's been real relevant,
mm-hmm.
not relevant, but in the news today. Can you once again compare and contrast and kind of put in perspective this struggle that we see going on and this attack on Libya, the comparing and contrast the relationship between Libya and Zimbabwe.
Oh, wow.
Historically.
Libya is definitely a battlefield tonight. But let me just let apologists for U.S. imperialism know that you can win. Battles are won and lost all the time. The winner of wars determine how we go forward in history. So they can celebrate what they want to celebrate. Libya, we have a positive example in terms of the historical index of the African liberation struggle of what type of societies we want to have. So if Gaddafi is defeated, if Gaddafi goes down, we know he'll go down fighting. But then we'll be able to say from 1969 to 2011, Africans in Libya had free health care. Africans in Libya had free education. Libya had a head of state that used the platform to deal with some of the other political, economic, social, and cultural challenges that the rest of the African continent faced. So we'll look at Gaddafi from 69 to 2011 the same way we look at Ghana under Nkrumah from 57 to 66, or Cabral and Guinea-Bissau from 69 to 73, or Patrice Lumumba, as this is the 50th anniversary of his assassination, for 6 months. Or Thomas Sankara from 1983 to 1987, Maurice Bishop from 1979 to 1983. Struggle is eternal. The struggle will continue in Libya. Zimbabwe is blessed to be a little better organized militarily, a little better organized in the area of intelligence, and the culture of unity is stronger in the region. The most disgusting thing about what happened in Libya is not actually what occurred on the ground in Libya, but what happened when the Arab League, as a unified body, decided to vote for the no-fly zone. That made Libya very vulnerable. Because the African Union as a total body takes its cue from the regional body. And every region has one. You have ECOWAS, you have SADC, and Zimbabwe is solid. As a matter of fact, Zimbabwe is just leaving Angola. Zimbabwe's leadership is just leaving Angola. Angola is presiding over SADC for the next year, and it was known once again they will be campaigning aggressively for the lifting of the Zimbabwe Democracy and Economic Recovery Act, and under no circumstances are they going to allow the West, in a diplomatic arena or a military capacity, try to bring about an illegal, racist, fascist, genocidal-driven regime change in Zimbabwe. So Zimbabwe's blessed to have its whole region behind them. And Botswana doesn't count anyway, because the United States can treat President Khama like a wind-up toy or a remote-controlled car, but when he comes before the rest of Southern Africa, he has to go along with the democratic norm, the democratic pulse of the whole region. So Libya did not have that. And so that's what we're witnessing. In terms of outside the African continent, we recognize that what Gaddafi did from 1969 to 2011, you can call it walking on eggshells, because in the final analysis, he is Arab. And because that's a very touching and painful chapter of our history, the Arab slave trade, the European slave trade too, but the Arab slave trade, and we've seen many acrimonious debates inside our community, which slave trade was more fascist, which one was more dangerous, which one was more dehumanizing. And so any Arab, Ben Bella in Algeria, Gamal Abdel Nasser in Egypt, Gaddafi, who learned and gained inspiration from both of those men, that tries to bridge the gap, apologizes for the atrocities of his ancestors, our people will still sleep with one eye open in his presence. They will never completely embrace him. For the same reason that people still attack Cuba. And remember those opportunists a few years ago that wrote that stupid statement about racism still existing in Cuba? They sounded yes. about as intelligent as Christopher Columbus did when he claimed to discover America and the hemisphere, because, of course, we make a distinction between the United States and America. But with that being said, so when they talked about racism existing in Cuba, Name a place where Europeans and Africans still coexist, where slavery and colonialism occurred, and racism still doesn't exist. The question isn't whether racism still exists. The question is, what steps are you taking to eradicate it? And what country in the Western Hemisphere is doing more to eradicate racism than Cuba? Certainly not the United States. And having our mirror image at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue hardly cuts it. Hardly cuts it. But getting back to the Libyan situation, I think that that's the thing that people should remember. And people should understand that they are now, Libya is about to, if Gaddafi is defeated, you will see a return back to monarchy. Because that's what the opposition to Gaddafi coming out of Benghazi has always represented. 24 hours after the fighting first started, they put up the flag of King Idris. A lot of people didn't even discuss that. I haven't heard many of the people who've been going around the country speaking about Libya even contextualize it to that degree. Have you?
No.
Have you heard that? I didn't hear it, and I was surprised, you know.
No.
And
not
I said,
all.
Wow, that was the most blatant statement of all. They were calling for a return to monarchy. So for people whose point of reference is Stolen Legacy by George E.M. James or The Destruction of Black Civilization by Chancellor Williams and other books, they should know that those are the Arabs that they should be condemning. Those are the Arabs that they should be focusing on. And then the last thing I'd like to say about it is we hear U.S. imperialism's media apparatus talking about they've never seen a shift this rapid at any point in the world. What's gone on in North Africa since the beginning of this year, what happened in Egypt, what's going on in Syria, what happened in Yemen. Isn't that what they've been telling people?
Yeah, pretty much.
How is that true when between 1957 and 1960, 35 countries in Africa overthrew their colonial ruler? Or in the 1990s? In the 1990s, when we were here fighting against police brutality, our sisters and brothers on the African continent overthrew Mobutu, overthrew Babangida and Abacha in Nigeria, overthrew Doe in Liberia, overthrew Mengistu in Ethiopia, overthrew Traore in Mali. So why are they acting like this isn't happening? What it is those efforts of UNITA and RENAMO got defeated in the 1990s. So we defeated military neocolonialism, found its grave in the African continent. Now we are going for civilian neocolonialism. So why are they acting like this didn't happen? So what you're about to see, but this is the other problem too, that North, and this is just my overview of Africa, and I'm willing to have anyone challenge it. North Africa is the most isolated region of Africa. Eastern Africa is the most chaotic region of Africa. Western Africa is the most corrupt region of Africa, and I'm saying that as a Nigerian. Yes, I said it. Western Africa is the most corrupt region in Africa, and Southern Africa is the most stable. So if we're remembering what we learned from Kwame Nkrumah, Osagyefor Kwame Nkrumah, he said defending your stable areas, defending liberated territory even takes priority over waging resistance in occupied territory, contested territory. We must defend what is stable. And if it wasn't for Southern Africa, the whole African continent would be a neo-colony tonight. So Gaddafi has... he did a wonderful job against odds that were almost but not insurmountable. And I'm sure that there's some 5-year-old, some 6-year-old, some 7-year-old that is watching their people being betrayed, watching their people being compromised, that is already sitting down thinking about when they get old enough how they're going to make those reactionaries, those mercenaries, those imperialist lapdogs that President Obama and Sarkozy and the British want to refer to as rebels, how they're going to make them pay, how they're going to line them up on the wall. There are already some babies in Libya thinking about that, and African ones too, indigenous, since we know that they're so-called black Libyans, indigenous African Libyans. There's some babies right now thinking about that, crying right now, having temper tantrums right now, because they can't believe how spineless those people are, that they will work at the behest of Barack Obama, work at the behest of the French, work at the behest of the Italians. And those babies are planning their demise already. So the fight is going to continue. So people shouldn't worry about it at all. And all temporary setbacks The Chinese say it best. They say to stumble is not to fall, it's only to fall forward faster. So progress is coming, and we'll learn valuable lessons from this, just like we've learned from all the other setbacks we've encountered. And our shift, I mean, of course, we've been telling people, oh, yeah, and lastly, we're going to begin an open letter campaign starting in September. Right now, we have a few appeals that are going to hit the street soon. An appeal, we're calling for journalists to sign on to it that are opposed to the sanctions on Zimbabwe, women who are opposed to the sanctions on Zimbabwe, and artists who are opposed to the sanctions on Zimbabwe, and clergy who are opposed to the sanctions. But imams can sign on to it, too. People who believe in the traditional African religions can sign on to it, too. But after that, we're going to start a letter-writing campaign about the sanctions in Zimbabwe. And the first person that I'm writing an open letter to, is the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan. The next person will be Mr. Danny Glover. And then I'm going to write a letter, a tribute to Martin Luther King when he wrote the letter from the Birmingham jail. This letter is going to be called The Last Word is Ours, and it's an open letter to the white left. The Last Word is Ours, an open letter to the white left. So, and it's in relationship to military repression and violence. And the Zimbabwe question is in the backdrop for all of those letters. None of them are antagonistic. None of them are disrespectful. I love the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan. Matter of fact, for many people who don't know, Sekou Touré is his political father, where Elijah Muhammad is his spiritual father. And Sekou Touré is one of my biggest influences. So we're family when it's all said and done. But it's to raise some very critical points about what we are doing in our community in relationship to this matter of Zimbabwe. And with Danny Glover, I respect Danny Glover. I respect Danny Glover. But TransAfrica has compromised this question of sanctions for too long, and it needs to be addressed. And the white left, it is what it is. It is what it is. We'll write you openly. You can respond openly. It's not directed to any of the groups. It's not directed to International Answer. It's not directed to Workers' World. It's not directed to any of the others. And it deals with white liberals, too. It deals with white liberals, too. And, you know, so if any of them want to deal with it, because, yeah, lastly, this is what I was thinking about, and I was laughing. One of the things that made me laugh when I was writing the play about African Liberation Day, I was thinking about Taylor Branch, because Taylor Branch with Tavis Smiley got on television last year and said that Martin Luther King decided to give his speech in Riverside about Vietnam because he didn't want to be associated with Kwame Ture and others that were going to be running around the streets of the United States waving a Viet Cong flag, because SNCC did have a slogan, Victory to Ho Chi Minh, in addition to Hell No, We Won't Go. Taylor Branch is a liar. Taylor Branch is a liar. He knows that Martin Luther King called Kwame Ture the night before he gave that speech and wanted him physically to be there when he found out he was in New York. And he wanted him to physically be there because SNCC came out against Vietnam a year and a half before Dr. King, and they're the ones who pressured Dr. King to come out against against the war in Vietnam. He knows this. And I was also thinking of William Minter, a white man who writes this newsletter, Africa Focus. And I talked to him a few years ago, and he had the audacity to say to me that since I write for the Herald, Zimbabwe's national newspaper, am I concerned about credibility issues? Here's an outsider feeling that he has the right to tell me that he sets the criteria for what is credible in terms of writing about contemporary developments in Africa. He's an outsider. I looked at him like a Martian coming to Earth telling me something like that. I was very insulted. So this would be a way to address them, because every now and then, because we are just by nature we explain ourselves a lot. We never justify ourselves. We owe no justification to anyone. But, you know, we'll explain ourselves. And sometimes because of that, we throw them a little bit of rope, and we give them latitude, and they abuse that latitude, and they talk sideways about our history. They talk sideways about our historical figures. They talk sideways about our organizations. So it's time to take that rope back. Our generation didn't give it to them in the first place, but we're going to let them know that we're taking it back.
Right. I want to thank you and Brother Baku for coming on, Obi. And I'll tell you this on behalf of Your World News and Andrea, we've already had the discussion. You can count us in on that, on both appeals.
Oh, no, I already know that. And thank you for everything that you've done so far. And thanks to Sister Andrea. I haven't met you yet, but I've heard great things about you. And you know Solomon, we're on the front line together, joined at the hip. And like I said, and thank you so much for giving Abeku this platform, because that is truly historic work that he's done in Cuba. He didn't come back with a bunch of pictures with Fidel Castro, like so many people do, and don't do any follow-up work. He's already immersed at the most intense level possible. And this is a 21-year-old we're talking about.
Yes.
Yeah. So it was just an honor to be on with him, and it's an honor to be fighting side by side with him.
Right. Well, you're welcome on, and he's welcome on anytime. It's an open invitation right now. As I said before, it's an open invitation.
Right.
So,
thank you.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. All right, Andrea. That was once again another great show. We're not done yet, but that was another great interview. And before, I'm gonna have a interlude right now, and then I get your feedback on this this interview we just had. But I think this what I'm about to play right now is very apropos. You know, Obi, you know, said something. You know, a lot of things that we should hang our mental teeth on. And one of those things was being historically responsible, because right now in America, school systems and the textbooks, by and large, they're very, very much historically irresponsible and limited. And so we let off the show. We're talking about Dr. King, but I want to play this to give us a brief buffer between us closing the show out. And I want to play this right now for you, Andre, and for everyone else who's listening, to place in context. And I want you folks to think about this so-called dedication that's coming up, and to think long and hard. Do you think that this, what you're about to hear, coincides with the individuals and these frauds that are going to be parading around, parading around the memorial site this coming Sunday, and are parading around right now? I mean, we have some folks that, not necessarily their fault, they have no historical point of view by design, and you know, and they're going to be rushing in there. They're going to be some of the 250,000 people there, our people, black and brown skin folks, and by design, you know, instead of mobilizing around ending these wars of imperialism, ending police brutality in our communities, ending foreclosures and capitalism's attack on our communities, they're going to be coming to D.C., Andre, in the hundreds of thousands for a superficial, at best, a superficial show of what they think is some kind of honoring of Dr. King, when really what I just described would be the best way to honor Dr. King, mobilizing, organizing to end these damn imperialist wars, to end, these white corporations' grip on and booting them out, like Operation Bread Basket was about, booting them out of our community by boycotting the hell out of them and supporting our own institutions. So anyways, I want to play this, and then I'll get your feedback on the other side, Andrea.
A time comes when silence is betrayal, even when pressed by the demands of inner truth. Men do not easily assume the task of opposing their government's policy, especially in time of war. Nor does the human spirit move without great difficulty against all the apathy of conformist thought within one's own bosom and in the surrounding world. And some of us who have already begun to break the silence of the night have found that the calling to speak is often a vocation of agony. But we must speak. We must speak with all the humility that is appropriate to our limited vision. But we must speak.
I've chosen to preach about the Wharton today because I agree with Dante that the hottest places in hell are reserved for those who, in a period of moral crisis, maintain their neutrality. Now, of course, one of the difficulties in speaking out today grows out of the fact that there are those who are seeking to equate dissent with disloyalty. It's a dark day in our nation when high-level authorities will seek to use every method to silence dissent. And I say that those who are seeking to make it appear that anyone who opposes the war is a fool or a traitor or an enemy of our soldiers is a person who has taken a stand against the best in our tradition. There will be no meaningful solution until some attempt is made to know these people and hear their broken cry. And I knew that I could never again raise my voice against the violence of the oppressed in the ghettos without having first spoken clearly to the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today, my own government. We are called to speak for the weak, for the voiceless, for the victims of our nation, and for those it calls enemy. For no document from human hands can make these humans any less our brothers. We are met by deep but understandable mistrust. To speak for them is to explain this lack of confidence in Western words, and especially their distrust of American intentions now. Now there is little left to build on save bitterness. The world now demands a maturity of America that we may not be able to achieve. I am as deeply concerned about our own troops there as anything else, for it occurs to me that what we are submitting them to is not simply the brutalizing process that goes on in any war where armies face each other and seek to destroy. We are adding cynicism to the process of death, for they must know after the short period there that none of the things we claim to be fighting for are really involved. And the more sophisticated surely realize that we are on the side of the wealthy and the secure, while we create a hell for the poor. Somehow this madness must cease. We must stop now. This way of settling differences is not just. A nation that continues year after year to spend more money on military defense than on programs of social uplift is approaching spiritual death. I speak as a citizen of the world. For the world as it stands aghast at the path we have taken, I speak as one who loves America, to the leaders of our own nation. The great initiative in this war is ours. The initiative to stop it must be ours.
Okay, Andrea, the initiative to stop it is ours. Does that sound like anything remotely that is parallel to Barack Obama, these other clowns that support the war directly and support the war indirectly with their fat mouth shut when it comes time to speak out against it, you know, because of the money that's lined up behind closed doors and so forth? You tell me. You heard it, Andrea.
It sure doesn't sound like the little bracelet you can buy for $5 online to support the memorial. I don't think that Dr. King was talking about that as one of the approaches to you know, changing this system of violence in the U.S. And all these different ways and forms that you can contribute monetarily to this memorial. I don't think that that was what he had in mind for people to do to change anything in this country. And yeah, it's nothing that he said at all is in line with the CEOs of GE or Boeing or McDonald's or Coca-Cola. It's just, I don't know. It's, and you know that none of these speeches are going to be played that day.
You know? No, of course not. Of course not. Well, of course not. These frauds, man. I mean, you're right on, Andrea. They're frauds. People, when you're listening right now, I don't give a damn if you're listening live or down the line. Listen, if you're listening live and you agree with what we're saying, call in. You know what I'm saying? Because, you know, I've heard enough of the folks that, I've heard enough of it, you know, listening to the radio, turning on the TV, just everywhere, seeing the newspapers of just people that just, you know, you know, just think that this is the greatest thing since sliced bread, and now have all of a sudden, you know, yeah, we're going to go out there and we're going to honor Dr. King's life, where really, I mean, they don't really give a damn, Andrea, about honoring his life. If they gave a damn about honoring his life, Andrea, like, you know what I'm saying, they would be honoring his word. I mean, you hear what he just said. I mean, he was talking about, listen, it's our duty to end these wars, to end these wars. It's our duty. It's our duty. The man called this country the greatest purveyor of violence on the face of the earth, you know what I'm saying, at a time when the just the atmosphere, not even just the rhetoric, but the atmosphere in general was pernicious, was deadly. I mean, at the very least, it was these things. I mean, you know, for a black man, I mean, they were getting away with killing black folks left and right. So he stood up for something that these clowns today that we see running around, you know, whether it's in the athletics, and I'm hard on them, because yeah, some of them just have no historical basis, but some know better, and they just, you know, it's just even for even lesser things that they could be utilizing their celebrity to raise the specter of consciousness, knowing that so many black and brown youth would hang on to their words, and if they came out and said, hey, you know what, completely against the war, you know what I'm saying, that would be enough. That'd be enough for, you know, millions of little kids to just jump on board and raise the specter of consciousness, much like, you know, Tommy Smith and John Carlos did when they raised their fists at the 68 Olympics in Mexico City. I mean, Andrea, it's disgusting. And you're right. You know, the bracelets, the trinkets, you know, these emails that just keep coming in. Like, I don't even know how, like, you know, just people forwarding. I'm like, listen, don't forward me this stuff anymore. You know, it's people forwarding stuff. You know, let's buy your Dr. King Memorial trinkets. Buy your Dr. King Memorial keepsakes. Buy them. Well, we're having a party at such and such club, a Dr. King party at such and such club in U Street in D.C. tonight. We're having such and such going on all week. A bunch of clowns. A bunch of brown and black skinned clowns running around. Now, yeah, I expect this. Yeah, and I would expect as much as Obi was leading towards the reactionary white left. I mean, I would expect that, you know, the reactionary white liberals. I mean, that's what they do. That's what they do. You know, they do superficial bullshit. That's what they do. You know, but for a bunch of black folks to be running around and doing this stuff, and which is a complete disrespect to Dr. King. It is a complete disrespect to him and everything that he was about. It's just repugnant, you know. You know, it's just, you know. You tell me, Andrea. You tell me that and if, the,
you know, his holiday and how people celebrate his holiday. And, like, there's all these, you know, volunteering events, and people are like, oh, you know, I'm going to go volunteer at such and such thing at the soup kitchen, or I'm going to, you know, whatever. Like, it's like, well, Dr. King didn't do it one day. Like, he did it his entire life. That's what it really means to work on behalf of a struggle. Like, you don't just do something for a day so that you can say, like, oh, I'm honoring the legacy of Dr. King because I planted a tree. Like, no, that's not what he was about. And so I just find that just, like, ironic. And even this whole, not only the sponsors, but, like, the ads that are all over D.C., with, like, Chevrolet and, like, pictures of, you know, it's, like, a huge ad with people from different races, something about, like, table of brotherhood. And it's just like, okay, first of all, it's not a post-racial society. Second of all, you're using this to, like, sell your product, which is, like, every sponsor that's on there. That's what they're doing. They're trying to, you know, say, like, we believe in Dr. King's vision of nonviolence and peace, but don't want to talk about everything else he was saying and what that really meant. And, I mean, it's just, it's ironic. It's, you know, like you said, it's disgusting. It's sad. Like, and I think, you know, I know that we mentioned this off air for a lot of young people. And I'm just thinking also, like, when I was younger, if I were to see this and I were to see, okay, all these corporate sponsors are supporting Dr. King, and my limited understanding of Dr. King, I would say, oh, well, you know, these corporations are probably conscious, and they, like, you know, they're not racist, because Dr. King was, you know, was all about ending racism, and so they're probably good. And so you start to be like, oh, you know, I'm going to buy this because such and such corporation is supporting Dr. King's memorial, and you have absolutely no historical context of what Dr. King said or who he was or what he stood for, and you also don't know the whole story behind these corporations, because we definitely don't learn that in school, and it's not exposed in the media. So, I mean, it creates a really confusing, just like, idea of society for children and even adults who are just, you know, have been raised in that. And but, you know, I just feel like with, at least with adults, you should at least investigate or, like, know better that, you know, everything isn't what it seems on the surface, but I think it's more damaging for the children that are growing up.
Right, without a doubt. And what did you think about the in-depth interview that we just had with Beku Dada and Obi Egbuna? You know, I want to hear your thoughts on that, because that was as rich a interview as we've ever had.
Yeah, I mean, I thought it was incredible. I think that you know, they are two people who are definitely really embodying the legacy of Dr. King by their actions and what they're doing. And I think that that's what it's about. You know, something that really stuck with me that Obi mentioned, you know, is the historical responsibility or being historically responsible. And I just thought that was a really brilliant way to put it, that, you know, we have to know our history, so we know what actions we need to take, but it's our responsibility for us to speak our history, because we're not going to be given, we already know, we're not going to be given information about our communities like we should be in the school system because of institutional racism and white supremacy. And so we have to take that responsibility upon ourselves, and then, you know, and not just, like, keeping it to ourselves. I know this is something you also say all the time, of just reading books to read or to make ourselves more knowledgeable, but to be able to share that with our community, with our family, with people that we speak to, and, you know, and offering them a different perspective and getting them to think. Because it's not from a capitalist perspective where I'm going to, you know, enrich myself mentally and keep it to myself so I can feel smart. It's about, I'm going to, you know, learn a lot so that I can know how to contribute to my society and you know, how to improve my society. And so I think that, you know, that's really what it's about. And what we try to say also in our radio show is that, you know, we're activists first and journalists second. You know, we think it's important to have our own media outlets, but it's it's also about doing the work and doing what we can to create a better community. So I think that, you know, we are obviously doing that with the Organization of African Doctors and all the work that Obi spoke about that he's doing with the sanctions in Zimbabwe. And I really appreciate it, too, how he values creative outlets for the struggle, because I feel like there's so many different approaches that you can take, and it's important to have multiple approaches, because different things reach different people. You know, everyone has their own way of contributing, and I think that history can be taught in an interesting way, and poetry and plays they're definitely a more interesting way to learn history, especially for children. And so I think that that's a beautiful thing, and I think that we can all really learn a lot from the work that both of them are doing, and why it's so important to do what we can and contribute in whatever talent, in whatever way we can to changing the past. And I'm just the last thing I'm going to say. I really liked his approach too of not thinking. With the example of Libya, for example, right now that Muammar Gaddafi is on the verge of being ousted out of his country or killed, not thinking of it like, you know, that's the end, but also remembering, like, he was in power for this number of years. And in that number of years, he did these things. Or just seeing it from our perspective, like, well, we resisted this. So at the same time that, you know, all these horrible things were occurring in our communities, we also need to talk about the resistance, because we focus so much on, oh, well, this happened, instead of, well, this is what we were doing at that time. And I think that that's a really valuable and a really empowering perspective to have. And so I really appreciated that.
Right. Yeah, I did too. That's why, that's one of those interviews that only comes around, actually, anytime we want them to come on. But in terms of that, those kind of interviews are never going to be showcased or highlighted on the corporate media for obviously, you know, the right reasons from the corporate media's perspective. I mean, given the fact what they do, the death destruction that they do through the infactual and one-sided propaganda that they put out there, that propaganda is put out there, Andrea, to support wars. It is to reinforce institutional racism and racist stereotypes that propaganda they put out there is to leave, you know, Americans completely obsequious to their whims, you know, at the same time, you know, having programming Americans to be against their own best interests. I mean, it's the kind of propaganda, because you have to look at it. It's informational terrorism. What is being put out there by the mainstream corporate media, literally, it costs people's lives. It kills people. Because if you have somebody out there who would have supported, say, for instance, single-payer health care, for instance, and the way the media put it out there in 2010 and not having any kind of balanced debate with folks, doctors and activists out there who are in support of a single payer, not the public options, but an actual single payer system, that by way of that debate not being presented on air, Andrea, that convinced a lot of folks that they should be completely against single payer, or at the very most for, you know, a so-called public option, which never occurred. And, it's the kind of thing that now, you know, down the line, you know, 4, 5, 6, 10 years down the line, if this country still has no single payer and these folks are not, pass away or contract some kind of disease that could have been, you know, curable. I mean, not curable, but removed. So I guess you could say curable by means of removing it, you know, before it metastasizes and they could have afforded it because it would have been provided for them for free from the state itself, then it is a killer. It is a killer. I mean, because those folks need to only look back 10 years prior to that and say, hey, you know, this is something that I, you know, a single payer system is something I should have voted for. I should have supported. I should have supported. And if more of us supported it, then it might have been around, and it might have been around here to save my life. Where but as we know now, you know, people are losing their homes and all kinds of things because of medical bills. You know, to the tune of what 76% of reason people go bankrupt is because of medical expenses. So, you know, it's just, you know, those people can say their argument about this, that, and the other, you know, trying to say the U.S. is the best healthcare system in the world. I mean, bullshit. It's not the case. But the corporate media operates the way it's supposed to, and that's why it would never facilitate a dialogue as what we had right there, right here this past past hour and a half with Obi and Abeku. They're not supposed to showcase 21-year-old brothers who are doing things in the field right now, who are talking about eliminating the brain drain and bringing more African doctors to the continent and to the African diaspora. You don't hear that or see that, not because it doesn't exist. You just don't see it because we're looking in all the wrong places. And if we're looking at the corporate media, CNN or what have you, then, you know, you know, you're just not going to get it. So we have to call these folks out. We have to call the folks out that we have to call these folks out loud and clear. The ones who will be crying the crocodile tears on the 28th, the ones who are, when you get an email from your buddies or this, that, and the other about buying a trinket or a keepsake, you have to call them out, confront your friends, say, damn it, what the hell are you doing? What the hell are you doing to really honor his legacy? What the hell are you doing? Because if you're going to go there and you're going to stand there, you're going to take some pictures with your 4G iPhone, you know, or whatever droid that you might have or whatever, and you're going to take pictures, you ain't honoring nothing. You're not honoring a damn thing. You're not honoring a damn thing. You're doing it. It's self-serving. It's for you to go home, as you kind of alluded to, Andrea, you know, when they talk about, you know, once a year they're going to go out on, you know, and volunteer in a homeless shelter. But, you know, the 364 other days a year, they're not doing a damn thing when it comes to, you know, working towards ending poverty, ending gentrification in their communities. Listen, don't go snapping the pictures. Tell your friends, don't snap the pictures. Tell them to get involved in some kind of movement. Get involved in their community. All right, even if it means from going door to door, house to house in your community, if it even means going in a community center and having dialogues where you're actually, how about just starting off by playing in its entirety Beyond Vietnam, Breaking the Silence, just playing that, and you can get it off of YouTube and you can download it to MP3, and yes, you can play it. You can burn it to a CD, play it from a boombox. You can play it. Play it for your friends. Have them listen. And then if you come away with thinking that Dr. King would be supporting this kind of bullshit that we're going to see on the 28th, surrounded by warmongers, then you need to have your head examined thoroughly, thoroughly, all right? Honoring him, you know, is not about this self-serving crap that unfortunately hundreds of thousands of people are going to be doing on the 28th, and going home feeling good about themselves, Andre. Going home, and I feel good. I feel good. I went, and I took a picture, and I had my girlfriend, or I had my boyfriend, or my wife, or my husband, or my kids take a picture of me in front of the memorial. And look at this picture I'm going to put up on my Facebook, a bunch of these internet activists looming and lurking on Facebook all day, sitting behind their keyboards, typing on Facebook, and not spending a damn minute in the community. Get the hell off Facebook, man. Get out in the community. Do something, all right? All right? Do something, all right? But these pictures You know what I'm saying? It means nothing. It's meaningless. Meaningless. Meaningless if you're not doing work in the community, if you're not committed to action, if you're not committed to action and solidarity with brothers and sisters who have been doing the work long before you got involved. Get involved with these kind of folks. Get involved. All right? Touch us up. Email us, man. Andre, it's Andrea at yourworldnews.com. Andrea at yourworldnews, not .com, .org. Andrea at yourworldnews.org. Mine is Solo, S-O-L-O, at yourworldnews.org. Hit us up. We'll put you in contact with folks who are doing some good work right now. We'll put you in contact into, you know, with some organizations. You can look on their websites. You can get in contact with folks and learn more, you know. But you're not honoring him with the pictures. You're not honoring him with going out there and buying the trinkets and sitting out there. You're just not. You're just not. Any last words, Andrea, before we adjourn from this special show that we just had?
I think you said it all. I hope to hear from people, or at least I hope that, you know, they'll consider our perspective and actually get involved in something that Dr. Kim would find valuable.
All right, so that you heard it there. Andrea had the quasi last word. I'm just having the last word just to say signing out. And for Your World News, I want to thank everyone. I want to thank our guests, Abeku and Brother Obi Egbuna, Abeku Dada and Obi Egbuna. I want to thank those two brothers for coming on and thank them for the work that they're doing. And, folks, another way if you want to get involved, hey, Obi put his email out there. Email him. You got his email address now. You got his email address. And if you didn't get it, rewind the show to where he gave his email address. Get in contact with him. Get in contact with him. Well, as a matter of fact, I'll take it a step further. All right? Make it easier for you. His email address is Obi, O-B-I-E-G-B-U-N-A, 15 at Gmail. That's O-B-I-E-G-B-U-N-A, 15 at Gmail. All right? We're doing it because we're activists first. We're not these part-time radio show hosts. We're doing this stuff because we're about the struggle and about liberation and about ending inequities and injustices, in any way we can. And that cannot occur without us connecting to you, the people. It cannot occur without us connecting to comrades, brothers and sisters who are doing the work and have been doing the work, quite frankly, since Andre and I were in diapers. So, this show is dedicated to you all for the work that you're doing. And, hopefully we're making you proud of us. And hopefully we can continue to put together a liberating show like Your World News. So until next time, this is Solomon on behalf of Andreas and Muyo and the rest of Your World News cast and family. Until next time, take care.